There was no investigation into the intent to crash because of his blood alcohol level.
Creepy is probably a bad word to use because I'm an escort. People are obviously going to be creepy.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Jess Hamilton, and it's my first week taking over from the wonderful Pip Rasmussen. I'm so excited to be joining Michael Bryden as my co-host and the awesome team here to bring you all the best stories from around Australia. Today we're talking about power and control, and in particular, the ways that people who need it most are taking it back. First up, Alex Christie dives into the world of meeting escorts online and how new tech is changing this age-old industry. A quick content warning, both our stories today deal with some adult themes and have a few naughty words.
One day when I was killing time online, I stumbled across a couple of escorts on Twitter. They were openly communicating with clients in a way I'd never seen before. Almost instantly, I became fascinated by the way a world that was formerly very private has become much more public. I came across Lulu. A quick scroll through her Twitter account sees her retweeting a clinical psychologist on the topic of sex worker rights. A few minutes later, Lulu sends out another tweet, this time directed at her customers. Available for last minute in-calls in the CBD until late. SMS me or book Violet's rendezvous. It's accompanied by a picture that is definitely not safe for work. Seeing this unfold in a public forum like Twitter, I became curious. I wanted to know, how are some of the world's newest methods for communication changing one of the world's oldest professions? Here's Lulu.
So when a new client contacts me, it's usually via email or SMS, and they'll say, this is my name, this is where I've seen you, I would like to see you on this day at this time for this long at your place or at my hotel.
She's a 26-year-old sex worker based in Sydney. She started her career working in a brothel, but now works independently, and most of her clients are secured online.
I'll respond back, I'll take a deposit, which is usually $50 or $100, and then they'll come to my place, I'll offer them a drink, pop in the shower, count the money really quickly. We have sex, and it's usually for a very small part of the booking. I guess a lot of people who aren't from the sex industry don't realise that the sex is actually such a small amount of the work that you actually do. They'll want to lay there and ask you every question under the sun and tell you that you're, you know, too good to be doing this, or what else are you doing, or ask you about something that you've written on social media, or about travels, or about some photo that you posted on Instagram.
In advertising her services via social media, Lulu can't help but blur the line between the personal and the professional.
So the first time it ever happened to me, I didn't really know how Twitter worked, and I had a client who booked me, and after we'd had sex and we were in the conversation time, he started relaying things to me that I'd said on social media and asking me about what I meant by them, which I thought was at first kind of strange because I had someone who I'd never met before who knew all of these things about me and all of these things that I'd said. So I find a lot of clients that I have really good conversations with and just mesh with much better than when I didn't have social media.
But as we all know, the internet can be a pretty mean place. I asked Lulu if she's ever been trolled on her Twitter account.
Oh, well, I had this guy who I actually think may have been a disgruntled client of mine, maybe from 2.5 years ago, who had finally found me on Twitter and would just comment on every single one of my posts and just say really horrible, nasty things, and I would just never reply. And he probably commented 100 times and then just gave up. But I guess that was more funny. He would say things like, oh, you fat, nasty slut, you're a whore, you don't deserve an opinion, and just really trying to get a reaction from me, which he just never got because there was just no point in reacting to it.
The internet gives sex workers more freedom and safety, but it does make them vulnerable to attacks online around their body, their performance, and their life choices. And while the experience of online abuse is hard enough, Lulu's Twitter profile has taken an emotional toll in other ways. Like one time after a long-haul flight.
My mum somehow found my Twitter profile. I was in the States and I came home completely jet-lagged, hadn't slept for 17 hours or something. And as soon as I got back into Sydney, she sent me a message saying we need to talk, and I knew exactly what it was. So that was really difficult because I guess the one person in the world that I didn't want to find out was my mum. She had gone through every tweet that I had posted and had had Twitter for 6 or 7 months. So she'd seen a lot of things that, in her words, she can't unsee.
Creepy is probably a bad word to use because I'm an escort. People are obviously going to be creepy.
That's another sex worker I spoke to, who I'll call Amy. She says the best thing about sex work online is how it allows you to get to know someone a little bit better before you meet up in real life.
So I think the internet is a really good way of being able to weed out people that vibe, that they're not people that you want to associate with. I think that's a big part of why these new sites and apps are so good for working girls. It puts the control back in their hands. I do or don't like the look of this guy. I don't or I do like what he's saying to me. And I think that that's a big part of it because a lot of people see us as a product, but we're actually providing a service, not a product.
Like, I'm a libertarian and I'm a capitalist. I think anyone should be able to do whatever they want to as long as they're not hurting anyone else and they're in a sound mental state.
That's the voice of Ruben Copper, a Sydney-based app developer and, disclaimer, the brother of a good friend of mine. Ruben has recently launched Rendezvous, a mobile phone app that connects escorts and their clients, the first of its kind in Australia. Rendezvous aims to please. For escorts, it provides a security mechanism, a way of connecting with clients that is private but also logged. While for clients, it provides an interface of readily available escorts, complete with real-time appointment data. Both parties benefit from a secure payment portal and review mechanisms, which in tech speak ensures there are only good actors in the system. Kind of like Uber, but for escorts. I met Ruben in his office. It's a nondescript building in the CBD. And appropriately, it's just a couple of doors down from Bobby's pole dancing studio and a couple of doors up from what Ruben tells me is known as a rub and tug. I asked him what it was like telling his parents about this latest venture.
I was nervous as fuck beforehand. I've never been nervous to anyone about it. I was so concerned about it. I don't know when I'd last had the feeling like that, kind of like breaking up with someone when you're 12 or something.
Ruben's belief in Rendezvous is typical of any entrepreneur. He speaks with an almost manic enthusiasm for the product and its potential benefits.
Look, from my side of things, I completely believe that the product is improving things for sex workers and for clients. I think it's classic disruption in that sense. And so I have no problem standing behind that. It's something that I think is going to do a lot of good as well as being commercial. The biggest potential moral issue that people could have with the application is that it will be fundamentally lowering the barriers to entry for an industry that is very difficult to work in. So, I mean, at the moment, we only onboard escorts who have an existing profile and a strong profile, and it's got scraping engines that run on Backpage, on Cracker, on a couple of directory sites, a Twitter account, so we will know if they are an escort who's already operating, but we wouldn't be wanting to onboard escorts who are inexperienced, basically.
Both the escorts I spoke to were excited about the impact an app could have on the sex industry. They did voice concerns about the business's ability to balance financial gain and the safety of escorts. But what both women loved about tech development in the industry is the way it's given them a greater sense of independence and flexibility. Here's Amy again.
I think that the internet has made things totally more accessible, has broadened the spectrum completely. A lot of the girls that I know go to uni and they work and other jobs. And this is just a side thing for them, and I totally respect that. And I think the internet definitely helps that as well, so you don't have to make a full commitment to being part of an agency or working for a certain person. So I think that's a good thing.
Lulu thinks it's unlikely her Twitter feed will make sex work seem more accessible as a job option. But she does have followers whose perspectives on the industry have changed since they discovered her account.
I do post a lot about my personal life on my social media accounts, obviously withholding some information. And this is not just me, there's 1,000 other sex workers with social media accounts who are far more interesting than mine, I'm sure. But we all make it more real for somebody. We are real people and we are everybody. Anybody can do what we do. It's not as terrifying or as taboo as what it used to be. And so I have a lot of girls and guys write to me who want to join the industry and have a lot of questions. Or just want to reach out and say like, oh, hey, I never considered sex workers or sex workers' rights. So I'm really, really glad that you're on social media and you've just made me think about something that I never would before.
One of the best things that tech development, in particular social media, has brought to the sex industry is a platform for activism, a place for people to fight for the rights of sex workers and be vocal about the normalisation of sex work in the community.
Well, I joined the sex industry when there were already thousands of girls around the world with Twitter accounts and social media using it as a platform, not only for advertising, but also for activism within the industry, which I think is most important and most interesting about what social media has done. I see a lot of women coming together to support each other in different ways, whether it be just taking photos of your nail polish and hashtagging, or something happens to someone, there's a platform for support that I guess that person might not otherwise have, because for the most part, people in the sex industry don't really have too much support from their friends or their family. Like, obviously there are a lot of people who do, who are completely out, but up until 6 months ago, none of my friends or family outside of work knew. So it was really important for me to have an online support network of people who I could turn to at any time, even if it was just to vent about a client or something. It's nice to have that.
The more you talk about it, it's such a kind of natural, no-brainer idea. It makes sense as a normal product to have for an industry. But part of the point is also the normalization of sex work or sex workers. They're really interesting, sort of the ultimate entrepreneurial kind of people. And once you're sort of working with them like that as users of a system, it kind of normalizes it even further.
And as Ruben points out, it's so rare now for someone to say, I wish there was an app for that, and for that app not to exist.
There's so many things that I never thought would be a thing until I got Twitter, and they're a thing.
That story was from Alex Christie, with help from supervising producer Jess Binneth and sound design by Alina Godwin. I'm Jess Hamilton, and today on All the Best, we're talking about control and power, the feeling of losing it and the feeling of taking it back. A quick heads up, this next story deals with violence and sensitive themes. In 2013, Beck was engaged to her boyfriend. It was also the year they broke up. They used to fight, a lot, and on the night of their last big fight, he stormed out of the house to calm down. Beck was feeling completely hopeless. So hopeless, she decided she wanted to end her own life with a kitchen knife at home. But suddenly she was interrupted by the couple living next door who were fighting loudly. According to Beck, everyone in the neighbourhood knew this woman's partner was violent towards her, but no one really did much to intervene. No one knew what to do. Beck could hear the woman screaming, call the police, to whoever might be listening. Beck put down the knife she was going to use to kill herself and instead called the police. In a way, Beck's neighbours stopped her from killing herself that night. But they saved her life in more ways than one, because they also made her realise something she'd never properly acknowledged, that she was in the same situation as the woman next door. Again, this story can get a little heavy, but it's a story that Beck has wanted to tell for a long time. Here she is.
I met my fiancé when I was 23. At the time, I was in a few bands, regularly gigging at large venues and had a thriving social life. He started coming to the local jam nights to watch me play and eventually asked me out. After our first date, we spent almost every day together. Even when we didn't see each other, I was always getting texts that he was thinking about me or asking what my day was like and what I was doing. At the time, I thought it was really nice. Our relationship progressed so fast, I barely had time to think for myself about what I wanted. But after a while, spending time together seemed to take priority over all my other friendships and commitments. Most of my close friends lived far away and they weren't very reliable. I was working two jobs, I was totally burnt out, and after a while I started thinking he was the only person who really cared about me. He kept telling me I deserved better from my friends, which led me to isolate myself from them. My whole world was this one person who was truly there for me when no one else was. That was 2.5 years ago now. And since then, life has really changed. I've had burning questions inside me ever since, ones I've grappled with for a really long time. I've been given a really amazing opportunity to tell my story and get it off my chest. The first thing I want to figure out is how did I end up in the last place I ever thought I would, a violent relationship. I started on my quest by talking to Dr. Joe Spangaro.
I guess I got interested when I was studying as an undergraduate and looked at a lot of the lack of strong laws in relation, probably particularly to sexual violence, and just got really interested in it from a feminist point of view and from a kind of wanting to rebalance some of the injustices against women.
Dr. Spangaro is a specialist on domestic violence. She has a PhD and has been working in the field for over 25 years.
We know that this is really common behaviour. So we know that about 35% of women who've ever been in a relationship will have experienced one form of sexual, physical or psychological abuse.
For a long time, I didn't know I was a victim of domestic violence. The first signs I recognised didn't actually feel like red flags at the time. It started out with stuff like, you know, he'd knock into me as he walked past and said that I was in the way. He'd take jokes too far. He learnt what my insecurities were, and after a while, he figured out that he could use them to manipulate me. I started seeing a therapist to deal with it all, and any headway I made with my therapy, he'd tell me that I was changed and that he didn't like who I was becoming. Everyone kept telling me what a nice guy he was and how lucky I was to have him. He'd tell me the same as well, and after a while I believed them, and I wondered what someone like him was doing with someone like me. Dr. Spangaro has treated a lot of perpetrators of domestic violence.
The guys that I have known, often they don't feel powerful. They often see themselves as being a victim. And sometimes they've had some traumatic experiences in their lives. Sometimes they've seen this kind of stuff going on in their own childhoods. And they think that it's normal, but they often don't feel like strong, control, in charge people. But they'll often have a sense of entitlement.
That sense of entitlement reminded me of a very confronting episode of Q&A I watched a few weeks ago. It involved the writer Van Badham. She was on the panel alongside radio broadcaster Steve Price, and I noticed some parallels between the way I was treated in the past and the way that Steve Price spoke to Van. How he dismissed her as if her views didn't matter and the way that he put her down on national television I found really disturbing. I noticed Steve immediately used this platform to defend a joke that his friends made in the media that made light of violence against women.
I think too much was made of what was originally a joke on a football show.
Here's what Van said in response.
Yeah, they apologised and that's fine, but on the receiving end is the ludicrous proportion of women who do endure violence.
I think you're just being hysterical.
It's probably my ovaries making me do it.
In my view, this sort of attitude is at the core of domestic violence. One person takes it upon themselves to be in charge and to think of someone else as less than themselves. This is the foundation for inequality and abuse. I talked to Van over the phone not long after it happened, and I told her how it made me feel. She summarises it better than I can.
Once upon a time, until quite recently, in Australian society and obviously in a lot of other places in the world, if you were a man, you could wake up in the morning and feel superior to 51% of the population because the entire culture around you promoted an idea of male supremacy, that men were the heads of households and men were the decision makers and men had jobs. In parts of Australia, rape in marriage was still legal until 1995.
Luckily, today, women have more rights and more power. Lucky, right? Maybe that's why I'm so used to hearing my absolute least favourite question.
We do often ask, you know, why didn't she leave? Why didn't she get out of it?
Probably one of the most repetitive and frustrating phrases thrown at people who should be commended for what they survived.
It's really interesting how quickly we'll turn this around and be focusing on the victim's behaviour or the woman's behaviour and not the guy's behaviour, and I think that that reflects a real gender imbalance in our community where we kind of expect boys will be boys and we don't often hold men to account for things, but we very often do hold women responsible for being victims of sexual violence. I mean, go figure.
It's really complicated trying to pull the contributing factors apart and give a simple explanation to this question. To start with, it was all so gradual that I didn't even notice it. When I did start to notice the signs, he was gaslighting me. And it made me question my own sanity. And it made me wonder if I could even accurately remember events that actually happened. The other thing is, we were in a committed relationship. He'd asked me to marry him, and I said yes. And in my mind at the time, I thought, well, that's what relationships are. You don't give up on them. So I thought that it was my job to stick by him despite his flaws, just like he stuck by me through mine. When the abuse got a little bit more obvious and potentially dangerous, that's when the fear came in. You know, I did start wondering, you know, if he can do this to me now, what will he do if he's angry or if I try to leave? So after a while, when I felt like my life was in danger, I thought it was safer for me to play happy family. But the worst thing for me was the embarrassment, you know, of actually coming forward and telling all of my friends and family that not only am I cancelling a wedding, but I was a complete idiot to love somebody like him in the first place. Eventually, I wanted to go to the police, but I was scared if he wised up to the fact that I wanted to press charges or leave, he would succeed in killing me, because there'd be nothing left for him to lose except his control.
So I think there's a few things that are often going on. One is that often this is a person that, and I'll say she really loves, okay? This is a person they want to stand by. Sometimes they're married, sometimes they're not, but it's a person that they love and want to support and want to forgive. Lots of the time when it's ongoing patterns of coercive control, the person experiencing that is often has their self-esteem eroded and their sense of self eroded and their sense of their own judgment eroded. And so they may well be believing the person who's hurting them that really it is their fault, it's not that bad, that they have been asking for it. And so very often there's that real total loss of sense of personal entitlement that this is actually not okay.
When people ask, why don't you leave? I think it's important we remember just how serious this situation is. Movies like Once Were Warriors and What's Love Got to Do with It, you know, the one with Ike and Tina Turner, they show the very real horror of living with an abusive partner, but they don't really show the very real dangers that come afterwards when you do leave.
Because it's the time when often this person has actually lost control. All of their threats, their controlling behaviour, their violence isn't working anymore and she's gone. And they feel like they've got nothing to lose. It's why those crimes where it's a homicide-suicide are so common.
As part of my journey to understand why domestic violence happens, I spoke to a couple of other survivors. One story in particular stood out for me. Brenda's story was really hard to hear. She was with her husband, on and off, for 15 years. Every time she left, he'd find her. Over the years, it got worse and worse, until one day, he drank a bottle of rum, put Brenda and her daughter in the car to go visit his cousin. He deliberately drove on the wrong side of the road, ending in a head-on collision. There was a family in that other car, and their 9-year-old daughter was killed. Brenda's husband was charged with DUI and sentenced to 3 years, which was later reduced to 18 months. There was no investigation into the intent to crash because of his blood alcohol level. He had no remorse.
But no one came and said, I'll help you. They sort of looked down at you, actually, and say, and then I think, thanks for the support. And I did, I rose above it and come out, I wouldn't say unscathed.
Her story immediately reminded me of something Dr. Spangaro said when we spoke.
One of the things that we really know about people who use violence or abuse or control in relationships is that they don't take responsibility for their behaviour. That's one of the kind of hallmarks, it's one of the defining features really. And in fact, if you know, these are people who have such little control over their behaviour, then, you know, why do we trust them behind the wheels of cars or in responsible jobs, you know?
Brenda didn't have the same support I did from family or friends. She's really lucky to be alive, and her positive outlook on life is really inspiring.
You're going to be scarred from it. You're not ever going to... It's happened. You can't turn the clock back and make it not happen, which is sad, but it's just a part of you that's always there. So, but my focus now is I can help one person to get out of it and to become really strong and rise above it. And there's one thing that these abusers hate the most is people that come out of it. They don't like it, and it's great.
This brings me to another question survivors get all the time. Why don't you just get help from the police? To answer that, let me tell you a short story. When I first realised what was happening to me, I started to keep a diary. I'd had a bad experience a few years previously of police not believing me without proof. So I figured keeping track of my fiancé's behaviour this time might be a good idea, just in case it escalated. Here's an example of what I would write. We had another fight yesterday night. He pushed me on the floor and he got me on my back looking up at the ceiling. He picked me up by the ankles and slowly lifted them in the air until I was vertical. My chin was pressed onto my chest and the weight of my entire body was bearing down on my neck. And I remember thinking, this is it. He doesn't realise he's about to kill me. It was like he was in slow motion, waiting for my neck to break and for everything to go black. My neck cracked, and it was the sound of it that was the most terrifying. He kept watching me gasp for breath, and his head just tilted to the side and a curious look on his face. Amazingly, after the longest 30 seconds of my life, I could breathe again and I could move. I was okay. The first time I called the police, he'd run away before they arrived. They said that there was no proof that he'd done anything because I was there alone, despite my diary entries and my account of what happened. The second time I called the police was when he forced his way into the apartment. We'd broken up and he came over just to grab some of his stuff. The policeman said that there wasn't much that could be done, first of all because he was still on the lease, so he had every right to be there, but secondly because it was the Christmas holidays and it would take about 2 months to get an AVO hearing. It wasn't until the third time I went to the police that I'd finally found the courage to press charges. I'd just moved back to Sydney and I felt safe, with about 10 hours of distance between us. The policewoman I spoke to was heavily pregnant and married, but I could almost feel her judgment and assumptions about what I must be like to end up in this relationship. She told me I couldn't press charges anymore because I was no longer in the relationship or receiving threats or injuries. She told me next time to just make sure I pressed charges when I was still in the relationship. I found that interesting. Next time. I was so angry and totally defeated. I wondered why people were able to press charges for other crimes months, even years later. 2.5 years later, I haven't thought about pressing charges. I just don't have the energy to keep justifying myself for something I shouldn't have had to suffer through in the first place. So how can we stop men from starting this behaviour in the first place?
80% of the people who experience abuse in relationship are women, 80% of the people who perpetrate controlling behaviours in relationship are men. It's not always the case. Sometimes men experience this, sometimes women are abusive, and sometimes in same-sex couples this behaviour happens as well.
80% is a pretty huge majority. So I spoke to Hunter Johnson, the founder of The Man Cave, which is a group that works with young men to combat toxic masculinity.
I think a lot of the discussion around the domestic violence conversation is around the band-aid solutions. And I think we look at funding, particularly the recent funding from the election is in really important crisis management cases, but we see a real lack of funding in the preventative space. And we think that if you can provide boys to self-regulate their emotion, to develop connection and empathy, then that can be, you know, that can stop, put a line in the sand before, you know, violence takes place. And one of the guiding lessons we have is that, you know, with self-awareness comes choice, and with choice comes positive action.
As a survivor of domestic violence, I've always felt like I never owned my own story. There's always that man that experienced it, or that person's life that was ruined, or that woman that had it worse. But making this story has been a chance to take control of what happened to me. every person that speaks out about this stuff helps raise awareness, and all of these problems get harder for us to ignore. Guys need to talk to other guys, to their friends, and let them know that this stuff is not okay. We are all accountable for what's going on, and by ignoring the problems, we end up feeding them. We have to be on the side of the victims and survivors, even if it means acknowledging an ugly side of someone we know.
I said to him one day, I said, you can beat me. I said, you can psychologically abuse me. You can nearly kill me. I said, but you'll never, ever take my soul. I said, because that's mine. And he didn't like that very much. And he would say, oh, you'll never be anything. You'll never be nothing. And in the end, I just drew a square and I said, see the space? I said, watch the space. I said, because I will be something and I will be somebody one day.
That story was by Rebecca with help from supervising producer Selena Shannon. If any parts of this story have affected you and you'd like to talk to someone, you can always call the Domestic Violence Counselling Line on 1800 RESPECT or 1800 737 732 or reach out to Lifeline 24 hours a day on 13 11 14. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Bethany Atkinson-Quinton. Tegan Nichols compiles our show. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Beck Fari is our SYN Production Manager. And I'm Jess Hamilton. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can also find our archive at allthebestradio.com. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.